Hi, I'm Sandy Snodgrass. Fentanyl contamination took the life of my beautiful son, Bruce. We can't bring Bruce back. Youth awareness and advocacy, however, will save lives. I urge every high school educator and student to go to sullivan.senate.gov/ONEPILL to learn how you can join the One Pill Can Kill media campaign competition.
The Trump administration's freeze on funds that support infrastructure, food supplies, renewable energy, and a host of other needed services across the state has created confusion and anxiety for community nonprofits and local governments. Will most funds be released in time for summer construction season, or will programs be cut entirely? No one has a crystal ball, but today on Talk of Alaska, we'll discuss what is clear, what isn't, and what it could mean for the state's economy and future.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Local, state, tribal, and federal government programs support a lot of the day-to-day services that keep communities running. Many of these programs are the work of nonprofits. Why are nonprofits needed for so many services? Why can't the free market make it work to provide childcare, supplemental food, education, and medical support? Why can't for-profit businesses run services that nonprofits have historically run? Here to help us better understand why the free market can't solve all things and why government support is likely always going to be needed in some areas is Lori Wolf. Lori is the president and CEO of the 4-Acre Group. 4-Acre supports nonprofits and tribal organizations across the state. And on the line from Juneau with us today is Nils Andreasen. Nils is the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League, AML, an organization of 165 cities, boroughs, and municipalities across Alaska. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for being on with us, Nils. And I would note before I get started on questions here that we've heard from more than 50 folks sending a form letter about concerns over the Trump administration. It starts out, the Trump administration is quietly gutting America's infrastructure. More than $20 billion in funding for public transit, highway projects, and clean energy investments has been frozen or redirected. And goes on to talk about the devastating impacts. So as I said, we've heard from more than 50 people with that that basic message. So let's start with sort of a basic health check. What are you hearing from nonprofits generally, Lori, about their level of concern and anxiety and what they are thinking or planning for right now? And then Nils will check in on municipal governments.
Thanks, Lori. Pleasure to be here. Thanks for the opportunity to have this conversation. There is so much concern, so much anxiety, and so much confusion out there. We're releasing a report today with over 300 responses from nonprofits all across our state, and huge concerns for very good reasons. We're going to see it would be devastating, this loss of funding. So. And I think to be clear, even organizations that are not don't receive federal funding directly, indirectly, we are a network of how Alaska works is when government, nonprofits and tribes all come together to make Alaska work along with private industry. And so you can't take one piece of us out of the equation or two parts of us out of the equation or three parts of us out of the equation and expect the for-profit world to exist all on its own. That's just not how Alaska works. And I think so we're talking about a massive impact on our economy, not just what happens to nonprofits. It will happen to all of us. And I think that understanding, that deep concern is front and center for our nonprofits and our local governments and our tribes. And but it will impact all of us. And we'll get into how and what that looks like as we go.
Yeah. Thank you, Lori, for getting us started here. And we will definitely drill down a bit. Nils, what Municipal government anxiety, what are you hearing from communities across the state?
Yeah, thanks, Lori. I think, you know, what initially there was a lot of confusion, with a lot of conflicting messages coming back and forth. And the biggest challenge, you know, is really managing that communication, the level and the noise, and really trying to determine what was real out of that and how that impacted local decision making. I think where we're at right now, at least for local governments, is, you know, we've kind of seen the lights come back on that they're corresponding or working with federal agencies to some extent. There's, you know, not as much communication as anyone would like, but, you know, we start kind of seeing things move forward a little bit better here and there. But that uncertainty, you know, overall puts us back, right? And for local governments in the midst of their budgeting cycles for this coming fiscal year, who are getting ready to deploy projects, brick and mortar activities this summer, that level of confusion and uncertainty, you know, just makes things more difficult and, you know, could delay any number of different projects that our members are really focused on this year.
Thanks, Nils. Lori, you had said previously that no one has clarity on when or if funding will be released. You said it's intentional confusion. Why do you think the lack of clarity is by design?
Well, I think the executive orders were clear in their effort, rapid fire, just so many, and the language is very uncertain. I was on a call recently with the Bar Association talking about the lack of clarity in the language. And so really we're seeing that played out now in the courts. There's over 70 lawsuits across the country trying to get clarity about what these words mean. And I think that, I don't know if that's by design, but it feels just so overwhelming. And the administration has said that is its intention to be, you know, clear in their goals. So I think the other thing that I'll just point out is that there is, in all of this uncertainty, there's also a chilling effect that is happening with our organizations, because even if they have been able to access some of the money, which right now they should be able to access all of the money because of those stays from the court, we know that some of them still cannot, and we know that a lot of that is based on the unclear language in the executive orders around their definitions of diversity, equity, inclusion. So that is creating a lot of anxiety in organizations about, you know, what they can and can't say, what they should and shouldn't do, what they should publish or not publish, and really we're getting at to the heart of the work that they do.
The report that you're releasing today, Lori, from the 4-Acre Group, how long have you been compiling this? This wasn't in response to what's just happened, I'm sure.
This is in response to what just happened.
Absolutely. You pulled this together. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So in the first, this is, I'd like to say this has been the longest month of my life, which really feels like more like a year or two. So in the first couple of days, we really said, like, what does this mean, right? Because nonprofits were absolutely panicking because the executive orders were so clear, and that OMB memo that followed were so clearly focused on our nonprofit organizations across the country. We wanted to know exactly what that meant here in Alaska. So we issued a survey very quickly that was very high level and got – and 48 hours over 150 responses, which for us is just unheard of. And that gave us enough signal to say, like, okay, we need more answers. And our delegation and their staff need more answers. And so we launched then a much deeper study. So that is publishing today, but it was 2 weeks in the field, over 300 responses. It's very raw. It's very and it's a point in time, but it does give us an indication of what would come if all of this money remains or is in fact deleted, frozen or deleted.
How bleak a point in time is it?
It's bleak. Alaska's nonprofits, you know, we don't have a county system of government in our state. And so our nonprofits fill the role that county governments would fill in other states. Our regional Native nonprofit organizations, the 12 regional organizations, are really like small governments, really. Yes. And they underneath that, you know, in that consortium is all the tribal entities, right? And that's how we do healthcare and public safety and utilities, and you know, are all the utilities in almost all the utilities, not all of them, but most of them are nonprofits, right? So even in Anchorage, when we turn on our lights, right, we're talking about a nonprofit, right? And when we our nonprofits are woven into the fabric of our lives here in Alaska. We can't just take them out of the process, out of the system, without every Alaskan noticing. So it's bleak. And some of our organizations are by design. Nonprofits fill the gap that either government can't or won't do. And it's not viable in the marketplace. We often are called in a democracy, we're called the third sector. We fill the gap. And so if you take us out, the gap gets bigger.
Nils, back to you. You had said in a previous interview that some agencies say drawdown opportunities are back and available. Describe what this is and what that means.
Yeah. So I think what we're hearing from federal agencies is that you're able to be reimbursed for work that's been done. And it varies by agency, you know, whether you're just able to draw down and immediately have access to those, or if you're submitting requests for reimbursement. But all the agencies that we're at least working with, you know, have signaled that they are able to pay for the work that has been done, you know, prior to the executive order. I think where there's still confusion is, can you proceed with the work that you are obligated to do, that you've got a contract or a grant agreement in place to move forward with? And, you know, that's where there's, and I think Lori said this too, that's where there's a lot of still some, you know, still uncertainty. Can we move forward? We have contractors who are waiting for a green light. We have staff who are waiting for a green light. You know, at a local government level, there's a lot of planning that goes into a summer construction season, but also just generally in delivering services to residents, that feels like we're still, you know, waiting through this temporary pause. And that's, you know, that's what makes this extremely difficult. You know, and for instance, we benefit from a lot of different relationships with federal agencies. And we had one agency reach out and say, you may now proceed with this work. But it's also true that they never said we shouldn't. It's the one communication out of, you know, 30 different agreements that have come through that gives us some signal that it's okay to move forward. But that level of communication and the lack of clarity, you know, just lends itself overall to a really challenging environment. In the same way that, you know, local government or that nonprofit leaders, you know, make up a big part of community and delivering services in Alaska. I'm struck by a quote that local government is a balancing act between immediate needs, long-term planning, and a constantly evolving landscape. The landscape right now is evolving very quickly, and local government leaders are trying to be responsive to that, responsive to the needs of residents. They're hearing the same thing that our congressional delegation and state leaders are, and there's an expectation that local government leaders address it within each community.
Nils, for some of the projects that have been told they can start back up, there's infrastructure projects, harbor, roads, sewer, water, coastal erosion mitigation. Nothing controversial, it would seem. Are these the types of projects that are now starting to unfreeze? And how quickly can people ramp back up? Do they trust this?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack in that question. I think for local governments, yeah, this is brick and mortar type activities. This is fixing potholes, improving bridges, making sure that our fishing and cruise ship industry can access ports and harbors, make improvements to water and wastewater systems, conduct hazard mitigation activities. It's really, I mean, very traditional infrastructure development that local governments are, trying to work to address. They're not political, right? It's just, very straightforward activities. I think the question, so they're also high dollar activities. So we're talking about millions of dollars that would go into any one of those projects. And the question, I think you're within your question around, do we trust that on the other side of us making a commitment to $1 million or multi-million dollar project, that will be reimbursed by the federal government? That's really been called into question. And that's, I think, where local governments, where they're moving forward, they can do some work at a staff level, but making those big commitments as fiduciary responsibilities, as stewards of the public trust and taxpayer dollars, that's really challenging to not know whether something's going to change again at the federal level and they won't be able to recoup the dollars they expend.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and today we're talking about Alaska's nonprofits and municipal governments and frozen federal funds, confusion around when or if those funds will be released and which ones will, which ones will not. In the studio with me is Lori Wolf. Lori is the president and CEO of the 4-Acre Group that supports nonprofit organizations and tribal organizations across the state. And Nils Andreasen is the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League. He is in Juneau and joins us from there. So, Lori, you noted previously that the executive orders targeted nonprofits more than other organizations. What do you know about why nonprofits are the particular focus?
We don't.
Interesting.
We don't know. Yeah, it's never a good idea to guess about people's intentions or motives. So we don't. There's certainly lots of chatter out there, lots to read, and lots of opinions of varying degrees about why that is.
But no certainty.
Yeah, no certainty. I did want to just, if I could, just pick up one of the pieces that Nils just brought up, which I think is so important about the trust piece, which I think we'd all be remiss if we didn't talk about the loss of our federal workers in our state. And, those were some of our trusted partners in this work. And I know that local governments and nonprofits, we can't do this work without those partners in many of our communities. And so just want to echo that's part of that trust network is those people who are Alaskans, who are doing amazing work. And we already feel their loss.
And Lori, nonprofits can, and maybe some already have, could sue if their funds were approved by Congress but canceled in these latest executive orders. But how difficult is the prospect of mounting a lawsuit against the federal government, especially for small nonprofits?
So hard. We're seeing, again, I was in this. I'm trying to learn as much about that process as I can. I'm not a lawyer. 4-Acre is not a law firm. And this is new territory for us for sure. But I am trying to do a deep dive as much as I can. And my understanding at this moment is really what we're seeing in the landscape with these 70 plus lawsuits in these last month or so is that they're mostly class action lawsuits for the most part, or they're very large organizations that already had built-in kind of legal counsel, and I think that's who we're seeing kind of show up in this moment. But certainly we're talking about, right, the next wave is individual organizations trying to unfreeze or get the money that Congress has approved. And in many cases, the money has already been spent. We work on a reimbursement basis. So the money has already been spent. We're just trying to get the funds back. I think it's almost, it seems highly unlikely that small grassroots organizations would have the capacity to do that. I mean, so at 4-Acre, we're really thinking deeply about, like, well, what does support look like in that arena, and what's our role in helping organizations think about that? And I don't know yet. We're just beginning to talk about it.
4 Acre probably doesn't have some fund dedicated to legal defense, does it?
No, but we're sure talking about it, right? Mm-hmm. How do we talk about a legal defense fund? I've said that word more times in the last week than I ever thought I would in my career, right? But these are just unknowable times, and we're taking out new ideas by the day and trying them out and seeing whether they'll actually be helpful.
Some courts have found that after 2 weeks, the administration was not following an order to unfreeze funds. What recourse is available for nonprofits now?
Yeah, we're seeing that right now. So I will say, as today, we're launching, you know, we have the survey of kind of what if at this moment, right? Because now lots of those organizations that have answered have been able to draw down some funds. But we still have a good handful. We're hearing every day organizations who still their funding is frozen. Or it's been canceled. We've had some organizations that have had your money is gone letters sent to them from federal agencies. And so we are actually setting up today on our website a place where people can report in the moment, our money is frozen, our money is gone, whatever that is. So because we just need to keep a handle on that. In terms of what they can do, one of the things the groups so far that we've been talking to, you know, we're having them raise their voice, talk to our delegation directly, talk to the legislature directly, bring their documentation in hand and talk about the impacts that are, you know, that it will have on Alaska, which are big. Mm-hmm. But in terms of legal recourse, they have it if they could afford it, and if they had the capacity, which most of them do not.
Let's go to the phones for a moment. Terry is in Valdez. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I can't help but think of all the parallels between the state of Alaska and the federal government. You look back at SB 21, that was a huge reversal of fortune for the state of Alaska, and all the cutbacks that ensued. The real answers to this is not only roll back the Trump tax cuts, but bring it back to the Clinton years where we had a balanced budget. And the Dunleavy administration and the Republicans in general have been cutting the oil revenues that we get through the pipeline. If we went back to a much higher level on our royalties, which should be the case, that is state-owned oil, if our oil, and if we just got more from what is being extracted from the state, we wouldn't have these shortfalls in our government. The only reason we have a ferry system right now is that the Biden administration bailed us out. And you look at the university system and the whole state infrastructure, the Richardson Highway where I live, they can't maintain it properly with the budget they've got. The answer to so many of these problems we're faced with is increased revenue. And so I'd really like to see us go back to the royalty we had when oil first flowed through the line.
All right.
The Hammond administration was able to do so much with that oil revenue.
Well, thank you, Terry, for a big round of concerns that you expressed. Appreciate your call. So I want to, Terry raised a lot of things of concern, and also the often stated desire by many Alaskans to get more revenue from oil. I wanted to talk a little bit about the diversity, equity, inclusion that has been such a huge target. Any of the DEI language is a big target of President Trump and Elon Musk. Lori, you said that Trump's definition of diversity, equity, and inclusion is confusing. What do you mean?
Well, the executive orders have language in them that reach beyond, they don't define what those words mean, first of all, and those are gigantic words that mean many things. And so there's no they don't offer any definitions of those things. But they go on in the executive order to talk about Marxist behavior and a number of other things that don't make lots of sense to most of our nonprofit organizations, or maybe even all of them. So there's just inherent confusion in the, they're written incredibly vague. And so our organizations, for example, again, we fill the gap, right? So lots of our organizations are serving people that could be considered diverse. Let's just take anyone that experiences a disability of any kind, right? And so all across the lifespan, right? So are they subject to that? Well, we don't know, right? So, or really anything. I mean, Alaska is an incredibly diverse place, yes, and its people and its landscape and its communities and its way of life. I think my daughter has there's 109 languages spoken only in her public school, right? So how do we're talking about Alaskans. Like, how do you take out those conversations, put them in a memo, and then tell organizations to figure it out? Like, they don't know what to do.
Or tell them to make it disappear.
And tell them to make it disappear, which is really just erasure of people. And we certainly at 4-Acre won't be part of that, or encouraging any sort of behavior that looks like that. And so we are seeing self-censorship happening with organizations who are afraid.
The university.
Yes. Yep. And many others, right? I mean, I think there's a piling on going on. The other piece that, you know, so there's fear. There's a chilling effect. There's self-censorship. And then there is this freeze of funding until you, quote, prove that you are not part of that, mm-hmm, even though we're not sure what part of that really means. So it's fair, you know, it's, you know, people are like, do I turn left or do I turn right? Or what, do I go forward? Like, what do I do? And I think, you know, that is just no way to run a business. Nonprofits are businesses. That little C in our 501c 32 numbers yeah, after that stands for corporation, right? You don't run a business based on confusion. That's not how we work.
So, Nils, how about communities? Has the administration's push to scrub DEI language from everything, programs affecting community benefits? How have communities grappled with that, and have they had to revise and resubmit proposals without DEI language?
Yeah. I don't think we haven't seen the full extent of it yet. And I am waiting for, you know, members to reach out and share, here's the negotiations they've gone through. I think there's, I mean, a few things. So DEI is kind of one piece of it. The prior administration's Justice 40 initiative was really focused on identifying and working to, you know, increase benefits to disadvantaged communities. And Alaska had a competitive advantage when it came to that. We were able to argue again and again that the majority of Alaska fit that definition, and federal funds could support the needs of Alaskans in ways that were really important. And when you think of Alaska as a young state with a pretty significant infrastructure deficit that, you know, 6 years ago we said was $30 billion or more, and federal funding these last few years has helped to address some portion of that, that the ability to address the needs of vulnerable communities, residents, is actually a good thing, and put us on a trajectory for community and economic development that a lot of our members, local government officials, were really looking forward to. They said that with this generational opportunity, we should make a generational effort. And so it feels like, you know, at this point that we're unwinding some of the intentionality around supporting the stressed communities that, you know, Alaska has so many of, mm-hmm, and trying to figure out, you know, what next steps look like. How do you unpack disadvantage or DEI from your pothole or your snow plowing activities or your water and sewer system? I don't know what that's going to look like. And we've also got a federal workforce that's diminished, that maybe not be in a position to help us work through how that should be implemented.
All right. Thank you, Nils. We are going to take a short break. When we come back, we will continue our discussion about how nonprofits and local municipalities are being affected by federal funding freezes as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today we're talking about Alaska's nonprofits and local municipalities and frozen federal funds and how that's affecting services across Alaska and may continue to affect services. In the studio with me is Lori Wolf. Lori is the president and CEO of the 4-Acre Group that supports nonprofits and tribal organizations across Alaska. And Niels Andreasen is on the line from Juneau. Niels is the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League. We're going to go back to the phones here for a moment. Matt is in Sitka. Hello.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having this show. I just have two kind of general questions. How many, in round numbers, people work for nonprofits in Alaska and would probably be negatively affected by this order? And how much, in round numbers, money do you have a ballpark figure in dollars is being threatened that would otherwise be spent in Alaska? I'll take my answer on the air. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that. And, you know, Lori, I was going to get to a question about a report that 4-Acre had released in January. Let's go to that now. 4-Acre released a report on nonprofit work in Alaska and the economic effect of that work. Report said nonprofits support nearly 55,000 jobs, and nonprofits generated $9.4 billion in revenue in 2023. That number surprised me. Talk about some of what makes up that significant amount of revenue and how things may look different for this area of community service and employment going forward.
Yeah, Lori, thank you. And thanks to the caller. Appreciate the question. Yeah, we're often a best kept secret in some cases. I don't think often Alaskans know how services are being delivered in their communities, you know, whether it's in partnership with our local governments or directly or partnership with the state or the feds or just directly from the nonprofits themselves. So, yeah, you're spot on that, you know, if we put all of Alaska's nonprofits into one category and called them an industry, which we don't, by the way, but if we did, we'd be the second largest industry in Alaska in terms of employment.
Wow.
So, right. And so I think, you know, and of course, what's driving that is healthcare. Healthcare almost entirely across Alaska is provided by our nonprofit organizations, our tribal health organizations, and other healthcare organizations. It's not 100%, but if you think about our clinic, you know, clinics, primary care,
especially in rural,
yeah, absolutely, rural Alaska, and it drives employment in rural Alaska. When we have health communities in or health nonprofit organizations in rural communities, you could see almost 40% of employment could be driven by that organization alone. So, you know, I think, and of course, they are federally funded, right? Healthcare has a huge connection with federal and state dollars. And so that's how we serve the underserved. That's, again, that fill the gap moment, right? So absolutely, we're talking about an economic impact across communities in a variety of ways, right? I think the other piece I think the caller was asking about is, you know, where does the money come from? And, you know, we have about last report we have is from 2023, $38 billion coming to the state of Alaska in federal funds. $34 billion of that goes directly to the state. Alaska's nonprofits get about, I don't have it quite in front of me, but about $1.2 billion directly. So, you know, I think we're talking about how we leverage that money, right? So we bring in earned income, we bring in philanthropic dollars, and we leverage every dollar, right?
And for both of you, Lori, I'll stay with you for a minute and then Niels pick it up. Talk about why nonprofits are a necessary piece of how the economy works, that there are some services, some things that are done that will never really make a profit. And so a for-profit business has no interest in picking this up. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's the one of the fundamental definitions of a nonprofit is that it experiences market failure, right? And it's not possible. It's not viable in the marketplace. When the IRS looks to see if you can have nonprofit status, one of the things that it's looking for is that you're not viable in the marketplace, and government either can't or won't provide that service. And so, again, that third sector space, that in the gap space. So you're talking about, again, that first wave with the IRS is a conversation about, like, how you fill a gap that does not exist in your community. Mm-hmm. And so if there's no one-for-one replacement here, you know, it's not a viable service.
Nils, pick it up there. Certain things that local governments have to do that if you had to go house to house to collect every household share of road upgrades and harbor improvements, it would never work.
Right. When we looked at Alaska's fiscal policy a few years back, and we revisit every once in a while, but when it comes to, you know, basically public administration, government spending in the state, as it pertains to kind of our gross domestic product, our GDP, I think it's in public spending is in the top third, and often that's pointed to as a weakness, but it's similarly true for all the territories of Canada, Yukon, Nunavut, Northwest Territories. It's also true for Florida, for Montana, for pick another state. Government spending is filling a gap that that really businesses and residents rely on. It's all the supportive infrastructure that make economies work or allow residents to, you know, feel like there's a community that that they can come back to and that they've got some hope for. And when it comes to local governments, you know, they're doing something similar. I think one of the things that I keep coming back to when thinking about our members is a big part of their job is to keep communities whole, whether that's offering the base level of services that they can afford or being full service municipalities and providing a wide range of services. They're doing a lot. And then where they're not able to, they're either looking to state or federal government to augment that, or to other partners within the community, and often turning to nonprofit partners who fill the gap, where it doesn't make sense to tax everybody, but there's a committed group of volunteers or others who want to make a difference in the community. And it's the combination of all of those who are really focused on thriving communities in Alaska.
For both of you, certainly waste, fraud, and corruption exists. The speed at which pandemic funds were released resulted in cases of fraud, people getting money that they shouldn't have. Shysters are out there. But overall, how big do you think government funding problems really are? Do you see areas of emergency need where budget slashing and employee firings are urgently needed because of theft? I mean, the speed at which these things are happening would seem to indicate that there's really an alarm about, I've seen no evidence of what's going on there, but have you, in your experience working in this field, are there lots of examples of waste and fraud and corruption? Lori, you're shaking your head no.
I'm shaking my head no. I'm like, I mean,
head nodding on the radio or shaking.
Yeah, sorry,
heard.
Sorry. For sure. I mean, I can't say there's never been.
Of course.
Right, of course. And when there is, we have a system in play for that, right? There's checks and balances in our system, and we catch bad actors, right? And we would never, we want bad actors to be caught, right? Because we also serve, as Nils said, in the public's trust, right? We serve a greater good. We always say, right, it's bigger than us. We're all replaceable, and it's bigger than us. We serve this bigger need. So is there bad actors? Well, sure. But are there more bad actors in the nonprofit sector than there are in the for-profit arena? Because they don't seem to be part of this conversation at all. And that doesn't make any sense to me, because there's plenty of examples of neglect or fraud in the for-profit arena, but that doesn't seem to be part of the conversation. So I have lots of questions about that.
How about you, Nils? Local governments and shenanigans with federal funds, do you see much problem there that would be so alarming?
No, I think a freeze and sprees are not the way to address inefficiencies. So sudden action at a federal or state level to address challenges that have been identified, aren't the way to address those challenges. Often I think what is perceived as an inefficiency is simply, local governments were required to do A, B, and C as a condition of a grant agreement. It's more than they wanted to, right? But they're following the law and the federal priorities. A sudden shift from one set of priorities to a new set of priorities I think not only does it cause confusion, but it kind of undermines this, or maybe it even leads to this idea that there's inefficiency, because it contributes to the inefficiency. It makes things more difficult to implement in a streamlined or simplified fashion. And instead you have to layer on additional requirements for all the projects that you want to do. So there's a natural tendency to bureaucracy and making things more complicated, but I don't know that there has to be. And the answer to making things more complicated is not getting rid of them. It is simplifying them in thoughtful and meaningful ways.
And I'll just add too, with a longer runway, right? I mean, I think if we want to change the way that services are delivered in our state, we need to have a conversation where all sectors come together with policymakers, and we have a real conversation about what services do Alaskans want, and what can they afford, and what are they willing to pay for, and how do they want them delivered? But that requires a runway. There's no runway here. This is just fast and furious.
All right, we are going to take one more quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about federal funding freezes and how nonprofits and local governments across Alaska are being affected by these funding holdups as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing federal funds and freezes that have disrupted the business of both nonprofits and local governments across Alaska. The Associated Press reported today that nearly 40% of the federal contracts that President Trump's administration claims to have canceled aren't expected to save the government any money. And that is in part because the total value of the contracts has already been fully obligated, which means the government has a legal requirement to spend the funds for the goods or services it purchased, and in many cases has already done so. A quote from Charles Tiefer, a retired University of Baltimore law professor, said, "It's like confiscating used ammunition after it's been shot when there's nothing left in it. It doesn't accomplish any policy objective." So back to the question of what's needed here. Representative Nick Begich said, he told Alaska's lawmakers that Alaska is too dependent on federal funds and needs to build up its own revenue sources. What do you think about that? Lori, I'll start with you and then we'll go to Nils.
Well, I think what I just said a moment ago, which is that if that's the choice of Alaskans and our policymakers, then let's have a conversation about it. And let's have a fiscal plan. Let's have a long runway to that plan. Let's have a...
You don't think it should be done in 2 months?
Or two days? No, I don't. and I don't think it needs to play out in the court system. I mean, I think that there's a way to have these conversations where people come to the table and have real conversations about the kind of communities we want to live in and who delivers those services and who pays for them. There's no such thing as a free service. Our nonprofit organizations may look like or our local governments may look like they're delivering free services, but they're not free. Someone is paying for them. So who do we want to pay for them? Mm-hmm. And what's the conversation that we need to have? And we can't just have one person having those conversations. We need to all be at the table having those conversations as Alaskans.
Well, and isn't it part of the office, OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, isn't it part of their purview and their responsibility to comb through departments, maybe take one each year and do a comprehensive review of all the programs to see where is funding going? Is it effective? Does it make sense? Instead of this level of disruption.
Yeah, I mean, if I were to make an analogy to our own nonprofit organizations, right, we say, well, you should have a strategic plan. You should know who you are. You should know where you're going. You should have a budget to match it, that is a values-based budget that also, you know, funds the things that you think are important, right? I mean, this is just, you should have scenario plans to tell you what to do if those things don't happen, right? This is just basic good governance that we ask our nonprofits to do all day long, but we're not applying that kind of writ large in these conversations.
Nils, turning back to you, we know rural communities struggle with affordable and reliable energy delivery, especially when storms or earthquakes damage them. Renewable systems, wind, solar, offer redundancy and backup and also alternatives to expensive fuel. $5 billion in clean energy infrastructure funds were frozen in early February. Do you have any information about whether any of the renewable energy funds will be unfrozen at some point?
Yeah, and maybe just really quickly on the previous question too, when it comes to, you know, should Alaska be more self-reliant, I'm struck by, you know, the, you know, statements at statehood back in, you know, 1959, when Alaska wasn't considered a worthwhile investment, when people said that Russia has sold us a sucked orange. And I don't want to live up to that prophecy, right? I don't want to think that Alaska is not worth investing in. And I hope our federal partners aren't feeling that way. We've got a governor who has highlighted just how extraordinarily rich we are in resources, how much more we have left to do. And that comes with investment. It comes with partnership. It comes with not just thinking about how to extract those resources, but how to invest in the people who live here. And I think then to tie it to the next question about the need to address energy affordability, security, and reliability. This is, again, a priority of our governor, who articulated a vision of 10-cent power across Alaska to a recent governor's energy security task force. Alaska can't do it on its own. It needs to have that partner at the federal and local and tribal level. And we have a long way to go to address the energy needs of our communities. If, in fact, those funds remain frozen, it will only set us back. We have had communities who are primed to move forward with renewables, with powerhouse upgrades, with grid resilience activities, all of whom are stopped work right now until they have a green light to move forward. And that's not going to contribute to the governor's vision for Alaska, nor our vision at statehood.
So, Nils, another area that was starting to ramp up in renewables was for electric vehicle charging stations. The Alaska Desk with Alaska Public Media reported last week that the State Energy Authority and Fairbanks Transportation Planners wanted to install nearly 100 EV ports in Fairbanks and more along the Richardson and Parks highways, starting this summer with $52 million from the federal National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program. You might guess where I'm heading with this. On February 6th, the Trump administration halted all new projects under this program. What do you hear from communities who want to install EV charging stations and make other energy upgrades about if this money may still come forward?
Yeah, I saw the, I think part of the news this morning that I was reading is that Curtis Thayer had noted that use of EVs in Alaska had quadrupled in recent years. So, I mean, I think in the same way that local, that government is providing basic infrastructure and, you know, other types of utilities, electric and water and wastewater, the, you know, roads that we drive on, it makes sense to think about a network of charging infrastructure that that it corresponds to the increase in demand for, you know, one type of vehicle or another. And I would also point to similar interest, you know, in the cruise ship industry or fishing industry as we're looking to and for solutions for high energy costs. So I think, you know, if we're not going to make investments in that charging infrastructure, it's again going to threaten some of the sustainability that we were working toward as we were aiming at becoming more self-reliant. And it will take investment, you know, by the state and federal government to get there. But without it, we will be less sustainable.
Beyond program funds, how much do rural communities depend on federal help? We've been hearing about lost federal employees around Park Service and other things, but in communities across the state, how will those cuts affect people that are in the community doing services for local folks?
I think I was thinking about it this morning in terms of something we come back to quite often. So we refer to some communities as gateway communities. So those are local governments who have federal lands within their jurisdiction and a really close working relationship with federal agencies, promoting not just the stewardship of those lands, but also access to and in support of a thriving travel and tourist economy, but also defense communities. And we have jurisdictions who are home to, you know, America's defense infrastructure, and they have cooperative agreements to address education and housing and infrastructure needs of both civilian and military personnel. That critical infrastructure is important to all of our communities, and I think scale matters. You know, there was a quote from the Denali Borough Mayor this morning that said, you know, we're worried about almost 10% of our community not having jobs on the other side of this federal firing spree. So I think that's important, right? With smaller communities comes an outsized impact when we're talking about people losing their jobs. Those are our neighbors, our classmates, fellow business people, and so on. And they're an important part of our economy and community.
Yeah. Lori, what's known today about funding for what are truly needed programs in Alaska, social safety net programs, people who need help getting food, domestic violence shelters, assistance with housing?
Yeah. So, I mean, the survey that we have, right, paints a very bleak picture of the absence of those services if we lose federal funds, both now or in the future. You know, I think you're talking about this, you know, the social safety net is really the nonprofit sector is holding up that social safety net as in partnership and in agreement with state and local and federal government. I mean, this was we created the system to work this way. And so, again, if you take out the funding component of it, I think we see them disappear. We see the safety net disappear. And, you know, unless the state of Alaska wants to come in and fund it all by themselves, which we haven't heard from them. So we don't know if that's possible. I think you also, you know, it raises a question for me, not just about this current fiscal year, but the next fiscal year for the we've talked about, you know, this issue of impoundment of current funding and the lawsuits that are going on. But we are also now looking at organizations who are applying or could be applying for the next round of federal funds coming from the government. And we know, for example, we saw a message already coming from the Office of Violence Against Women at the federal level saying, you can't apply. Well, that will impact every domestic violence shelter, rape crisis centers, child advocacy centers, which deal with children who have experienced sexual violence, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they are not being allowed to apply for the next round of funding. And we could see if those organizations have no other resources, which many of them don't, we would see them close their doors.
We only have about a minute left here. What do you both want Alaskans to do? What can they do to help just make their voices heard in this moment?
Well, I'd like them to use their voice. I would like them to. I think Alaskans, we often don't understand how services are delivered in our communities. We like them. We appreciate them. We would be lost without them, but we don't always know how they come. And so really just taking stock, looking around yourself and understanding how those services are delivered and what kind of partnerships exist for that to happen, whether it's nonprofits and local governments working together or nonprofits in the state or whoever that is, and really taking stock and then using their voice, having conversations with their elected officials and raising concerns about the need for those services in their community.
Thank you, Lori. And Nils, final word from you.
Yeah, I think our congressional delegation has an amazingly challenging job to navigate through a very complex political environment. They have been very responsive to a very detailed request for where something is stuck. Can they help get it unstuck? When it comes to some of the broader policy, we have to work through a budget process and the politics around a new administration and those priorities. But we have a great congressional delegation. They're doing a lot already. We want to keep making, you want to make sure they've got the information they need to keep making a difference on behalf of their constituents. Make sure that the legislature kind of knows what this looks like within your community.
All right.
While the state's working on fiscal policy, there's a lot more work to be done.
Thank you. We'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much to Lori Wolf, President and CEO of the 4-Acre Group, to Nils Andreasen, Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League. Thanks to our engineering team, Chris Hyde on the board today, our producer Madeline Rose, and on the phones, Wesley Early helped us out. And I'm Lori Townsend. Thanks for listening today. We'll be back next Tuesday. Have a great week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.